Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff McClure.
And hopefully that will be the only time you hear 1940s radio announcer voices this episode.
Why?
But it might come back.
1940s? It went into the 50s.
Okay.
It did.
Uh-huh. I take your word for it.
I remember.
You were there. Yeah.
I was there.
I misdecaded it. Maybe I should have said the 1920s through the night or 1950s radio voice. Would that have been better? I mean, voice of the 1980s and 90s had more in line with Sunday, 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 rather than who was that masked man? Well, now I have broken my own disclosure. I said we were going to try to avoid radio announcer voices. See what I just did there?
Yeah. Sunday, Sunday, Sunday.
Right. Monster trucks, stuff like that. They're right. Going to be involved in that advertisement. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we will be talking about more than monster trucks.
We will?
I assure you, but not in a promissory way. Right.
Okay. Right. Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, as you said, and the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of a potentially sleepy radio program, it is also our podcast, as the case may be, and it is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm based in Salado, Texas, that is registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which implies in no way that they approve of our they approve of our existence, but that's about as far as it goes.
I'm not sure that they actually approve of our existence, but they acknowledge our existence.
They authorize us to exist.
They didn't unauthorize us.
Right.
That is the extent. It's, if you've ever had a father figure relationship like that, that would make sense. I don't. I actually get acknowledged pretty regularly because the other guy that's talking on here is my father.
Huh?
Yeah. See, well, that wasn't an acknowledgement.
I am your father. Now. Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I've been acknowledged.
Well, I slept last night. I've slept since then.
So, next disclosure is that so we're registered with the SEC to give investment advice. Investment advice is fiduciary, and we can't do that on the air because we don't know all of you, and it's not private if we did. So, this is an educational radio program. We're going to hopefully give you something that you didn't know before. That's sometimes a high bar and sometimes not. It depends on how well you know finance. So we'll do our best. So this is an educational program. We're not going to give investment advice. So you won't hear us talking about whether or not you should buy an individual security of some kind. Because as I've told many, many people, an excavator, a backhoe, is maybe the best investment ever for the right person, and maybe the worst investment ever for almost everybody else. So that's all I have to say about that. Next disclosure, please.
We do not pay for this radio program, nor are we paid by KTEM to do the radio program. And if you're listening to a podcast, that's an irrelevancy. We do advertise on KTEM for the radio program, but then KTEM also advertises on KTEM for the radio program.
You know, there's a lot of like dried up seas out there that are no longer seas. Those are irrelevant seas too. I just wanted you to know that.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm already starting the bad puns. We're on a roll.
Irrelevant seas.
Yeah. Yeah.
I could argue that with you, but we need to get the disclosures out.
Yes. You want to say this last one. We did it in kind of a different order than usual, but if I do the next one, you're going to be frustrated for the rest of the day that you didn't get to say it.
No. Yes, yes.
So go ahead.
This is, as Jake said, this is an educational radio program and not investment advice. And on this educational radio program, we have obtained information that we're going to talk about. The information that we present has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. However, we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
By the way, nobody requires us to give that disclosure except him. He really likes saying it. There's not a legal, the SEC doesn't tell us that we have to tell you that we deem the information to be valid because they would assume that we would deem that so. But he likes to not give warranties or guarantees about.
Well, deem.
Yes, and he likes to deem. So get your deem. Go for it.
Well, I like to get my per diem. Per diem. Anyway,
demon.
The market. Yeah. We move to the market from here.
To the market. What happened this week?
It was an interesting week in the stock market because we had the first half end on Thursday, the first half of 2022. Our statistical measurements are normally by the week and on this program, but we also need to mention the half.
And also the quarter.
Well, yeah, I didn't pay much attention to the quarter. The half is bigger than the quarter.
Okay.
So we're at 4 bits. Instead of 2 bits, 4 bits, 6 bits, a dollar, we're at the 4 bits point.
Yes.
Yes, 4 bits is a half. Anyway, the index was down 2.21% for the week to in the S&P 500 index to 3825.33. It closed at 3818.83 on the last day of the second quarter. That means during the first quarter so far, during the third quarter so far, the index is up 1.06%.
Ooh, that sounds amazing. This is the highest rise in the first quarter that we've seen since the last time it rose this high.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So there's some kind of a record there. Usually you see it within the last year. If you read the headlines recently, this is the greatest move since 2 months ago. Really, really important stuff. Okay, go ahead.
Well, it's down. The S&P 500 was down just over 20% in the first half, which is not as low as it got because it actually came up a little bit because of last week. But that is, as the financial media is harking and crowing and barking about, that is the worst first half to a calendar year since 1970. And it is one of only two. It's one of the three worst since World War II in the first half of the year, which has no relevance whatsoever. But it's
a nice thing to say. I mean, this is the only time this has happened since this other time that it happened. That's the way headlines need to work to give people.
Right.
Oh, really? Oh, really? Did you know that this is the last time that we have had, or the first time that we've had a Saturday that was the 2nd of July in several years at least?
Right.
Yeah,
that's true.
And this is record-breaking information, but folks.
If we're going to, since the media, the financial news media, particularly the Wall Street Journal and so on, made a big deal out of this, we should look at that very carefully. Okay, so three times since World War II, we've had a 20% or greater decline in the first half of the year. So that obviously is significant, or they wouldn't be making so much noise about it. So let's look and see what happened in the second half of the year in those previous two episodes.
In those examples. Yes, this is good stuff, because if there's any relation at all, which we're not claiming, it's just kind of rhyming in a weird way.
Right.
They're all down the same amount in these time periods. And what happened in the second half of the year?
The market was much higher at the end of the year than it was at this point in the year in each of those cases. As a matter of fact, anytime we have seen this great a decline, 6 months later, the market has been higher since World War II. Now, is that any guarantee? Past performance, no guarantee of future returns. Share prices may be higher or lower when purchased than when sold.
Yes. So what we're saying is that, you know, when people come out and they say it's different this time and everybody points at them and says, they always say that and it's always the same. Well, it is always the same and it is always different this time. It really is, because it's a different era. It's different stocks that are behaving in a certain way. But people tend not to keep a market oversold for too long. And the reverse is true as well. It could last years, but people tend to not keep a market overbought for too long as well. That's why we have ups and downs in the market. So anyway, back to the market. I'm going down
also,
on my philosophy here.
We track another index, the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, because the S&P 500 tends to be dominated by very, very large companies, generally growth companies driving the performance, large growth companies. So if we go to mid-cap value companies, we're kind of going to the opposite extreme. You can say, why not small caps? Well, small caps are not in the S&P 500. So it declined the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index dropped 0.57% for the week and is down 12.83 year-to-date and is 7.49% where it was last year at this time. closed at 2266.01, which means it over the last year and so far this year, it has outperformed substantially the S&P 500 by dropping less. It's cold comfort, but it's working. The yield on the U.S. 10-year Treasury note ended at 2.894%, which if you're not following it, sounds okay. What's that mean? Well, it was up above 3. It actually got to 3.5% a couple of weeks ago, which means it's down quite a lot. It's 8% lower than it was last week, the yield. It's 1.5 points higher than it was last year at this time, which means it's way up compared to where it was last year at this time. But it's dropping, which is an interesting thing in light of the inflation information, which we'll talk about later.
Sounds like you're freestyle rapping there. Inflation information.
Well,
or at least at the same quality rap as a ninth grade school teacher in the 1990s.
Right.
So we're good at that. Go ahead.
And we'll talk about that a little later, but inflation is beginning to show signs of tailing off and reducing if we look at it from 1 year ago. The Bloomberg Treasury Total Return Index. Now, this is an important thing. That the most secure place that known to humanity and securities that you could put money is in U.S. Treasuries. It is down 10% so far this year. It's actually down a lot more if you count from last fall. It's down about 14%. So one of the things that's very significant about this market, there has been a myth for many years, for about 40 years, as a matter of fact, that if you mix stocks and bonds, you would get a less volatile portfolio because your bonds would tend to go up when stocks go down, and stocks, when stocks went up, bonds went down. That has not happened this time. The S&P 500 is down a bunch, obviously, just under 20%. The most secure bond portfolio that you could assemble is down about 14%. If you went with corporate bonds, you're down as much as the S&P 500.
So this is, so if for those of you that wish to impress your easily impressed friends, the word for this in academia, in finance circles, is they're showing positive correlation, the bond market and the stock market.
Yep.
And that will make people not understand you, but then probably ask you what the heck you're talking about. And it's easy then to say that they're both going down fast at the same time.
Yeah. So it's kind of an educational point for a lot of people. The famous 60-40 portfolio, the mixing of stocks and bonds, ensuring that you would have a less volatile return.
I'm not sure famous is the right word for it. I don't think this is one that is talked about in the tabloids much, but maybe famous. It's well known, the 60-40. Yes.
Well, it's been well published in a lot of books and so on.
Right.
Anyway.
It doesn't work that well.
So, but the Treasury yield curve, which we watch pretty carefully, is still positive, and that's very important. The 30-year Treasury bond is yielding 3.117%, and if you recall, the 2.894 for the 10-year, and then you come down to 2 years, it's 2.837%. That doesn't sound like a lot of difference, but it's pretty critical that even though the difference between the 2-year and the 30-year is not huge, it is positive towards the 30-year end. And historically, that has indicated that the economy will probably do better in the future and not worse. There's still a distinct possibility we could get a recession. We're going to talk a little more about that. But if we got one, what the Treasury yield curve is saying, it will be very mild. Now, that could change. It does 6 to 18 months forecast pretty accurately through history. So that's where that is. West Texas Intermediate crude oil is at 108.42 a barrel, which is up less than 1% for the week. Interestingly enough, the price of oil moving around doesn't affect the price of gasoline very much, because the issue that we're having that's causing the price of gasoline and diesel to be so high is refinery capability. And during the pandemic, a lot of refineries were shut down. Some were converted to doing something else, like post-processing biodiesel. They decided to put them on a big maintenance schedule because the price of oil and gasoline was very, very low, and people weren't burning very much gasoline. And now, for some reason, I can't imagine why, the oil companies and individual investors are hesitant to sink large amounts of money into building and refurbishing and converting refineries on a 30-year, because it takes about 30 years to recover their money with any reasonable return, in light of the fact that we're probably not going to be burning that much gasoline 10 years from now. I don't know why. They are not willing to ramp up gasoline production right now.
What I told you the whole listening audience last week about the CEO of Exxon saying that that by 2035 he expected the vast majority of vehicles to be electric, and by 2040 100% of passenger vehicles will be electric, and the debt to build refining capacity for gasoline stretches over a 30-year period. And if you look ahead, it's not 30 years to the point where they're probably not going to be able to sell very much gasoline. So, yeah, they're making good decisions. It's just difficult for us right now looking at it when you see these skyrocketing profitability. You know, I see the headlines of oil and gas company profits skyrocket, and then I see a Twitter or a Facebook or Instagram where they're talking about, oh, this is price gouging. The oil companies are squeezing us for all this work. They should just increase capacity. And well,
the problem, one of the problems they have, and obviously there's different problems, and there's plenty of problems to go around, is Russia's petroleum exports are no longer being accepted.
Right.
And they have a lot of refineries.
Yep.
And we're not accepting gas and diesel from their refineries. So that's cut a lot of it, cut a lot of supply out of the system. By the way, somebody is building refineries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is correct.
And it's going to be about a year before it comes in. The Saudis are building refineries like there's no tomorrow. And in some cases, they may be correct.
There may not be a tomorrow for some people. That is correct.
So sometime in 2023 is the best estimate that I've read so far for when gasoline prices will start to come back down again.
Now, I need to interject something here, because this concept, the conversation about electric and batteries and gasoline, is somewhat political.
It is?
Yeah. And it's baffling to me to see this as a political thing. It's purely economics. It's how much does it cost to run a car on electricity versus on gasoline? What is the transition point where you would say this makes sense? And we've already kind of passed over that in areas where the electric vehicles already exist. The lifetime cost of that vehicle is lower than internal combustion. There's a lot fewer parts to repair and so on. And this isn't me being an evangelist. I've got a gas-guzzling car. I drive what I drive. But when there's a new technology that's cheaper and by just about every account cooler, that's the psychological thought process of, hey, would you like to buy an electric vehicle? There's it doesn't matter if you're talking to a grandma or a 20-year-old, there's an attraction. Oh, I could get an electric. So that's a change in the market. And if the oil companies, the gas companies more likely, because they're not synonymous all the time, the people that are selling gas, if they decide, hey, the prices are up right now, let's spend a whole bunch of money so we can make more gas, they're really hurting themselves, because this may be one of the last times that they have this level of profitability selling gas.
And if I could draw a parallel that I've been thinking about and that you're familiar with, 100 years ago, one of the largest companies in the United States, one of the most stable companies in the United States, and one of the most productive corporations, member of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, was U.S. Leather.
Yeah, it was the number one energy transmission company on the planet. Energy transmission? Leather? Huh? Would
because like that's to explain? Leather belts are what were used to transmit energy from one place to another in a factory.
Steam engines with wheels were turned with belts made of leather.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people 100 years ago, this is hard to imagine, but it's real, a very large number of people, particularly on farms, were still using horses to propel their vehicles around, and the horses pulled things via leather straps.
Both the brakes and the accelerator was made of leather in these vehicles.
So the vehicles 100 years ago, at the beginning of the 1920s, were still largely powered by leather. And the leather was getting expensive because there was actually a shortage of leather at this point, 100 years ago, believe it or not.
There was also a shortage of clam and oyster shells. So there was expected to be an extremely high increase in the price of clothing because that's what buttons were made out of. Mm-hmm. There's a big article on our bathroom wall.
Yes, I know.
It's great. So you combine
this. That was 1908.
Right. So this is a little over 100 years ago. And something happened right then that changed the world. And U.S. leather is no longer one of the great companies on the planet. And if you talk about an oyster shell button, you're probably in an antique store.
As a matter of fact, U.S. leather is one of two companies that I know of that was in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and a decade or so later had ceased to exist. Nobody bought it. Its share price became absolutely worthless, and it just went away. Montgomery Ward's was one of them, and the other one was U.S. Leather.
And at no point during this time period, just as a side note, did a bunch of people get together and say, man, I just don't like leather anymore. Nobody got together and said, man, I just really prefer these other kind of buttons to oysters and clams. The price spoke, and then the habits changed. That's how technology works. We didn't move away from coal to natural gas because coal is dirty. I mean, you can claim that if you want to feel good about it, but we moved because natural gas was cheaper. It also happens to be cleaner. So when those combined, that's a win-win, and people can all get involved and go, oh, this is much better. But then at some point, some other technology will come along that becomes cheaper and cleaner, and that's what we'll use. This is the progression, and a lot of times throughout history, I mean, this is the nature of what a lot of our folk tales are about. John Henry was a steel-driving man, and he could drive that steel, but machines could do it faster. That's what that whole story is about. It's constant, and it goes all the way through our history. It's interesting that the Teamsters Union were literally Teamsters 100 years ago when we're talking about U.S. leather. They were the ones that could drive a team of 6 or 8 or 12 horses without over-damaging. And then they got switched over to driving trucks. Now they're still Teamsters, but there's no team. What happens when the trucks are driving themselves? Well, the Teamsters will probably stay as a union, unionizing some other area. They've already begun that process. So what we begin as, whether it's technology or bureaucracy, tends to change with the times. That's what we're saying about gasoline, is that gasoline prices being high right now is a greater push on electric research, because nobody wants to buy a gas guzzler right now. They're looking for something that isn't so expensive to drive. This pushes electricity. That's the nature of technology. Anyway, I'm babbling on, and I'm not even sure we're through talking about the market yet. We've got questions waiting, and we're talking about finance instead of answering questions about finance. It's horrible.
Since we're talking about the price of gas, I just wanted to throw one thing in there. There's a really good article that I read that pointed out that as a percentage of disposable income in the United States, gasoline prices right now are pretty close to the average they have been over the last 50 years.
Right.
In other words, gas prices aren't as high as you might think. It used to be that as a percentage of disposable income, they've actually been much higher on several occasions. So gasoline prices are not the big thing that we think they are. They're just higher than they used to be, which makes it uncomfortable. And by the way, I think gas prices will come back down again.
I agree.
It'll probably be 2023 at the earliest, but they'll be back down again to something far more reasonable, because I've just seen this boom and bust. It's very much like real estate. We're in the tail end of a real estate boom right now. Although I read some interesting articles on that, by the way, talking about markets. There are places around the country already where realtors are having to lower the price of houses 15% to sell them.
Yep. And I have a whole bunch to talk about on that subject.
Anyway, so we're done. We're done with the market.
All right. Well, we have a couple of questions from Inquisitor John, our most faithful and loyal of questioners. Inquisitor John, thank you very much once more. As is tradition, he's got a couple of questions that are highlighted with a digital picture of the paper Wall Street Journal emailed to us so that we could compare it to the digital version of the Wall Street Journal. And I have to admit to some great deal of nostalgia every time I see one of these pictures, but I'm also not missing the stacks and stacks of newspapers that used to pile up. So his first question is, the email is labeled lack of knowledge of inflation. There is a article called Inflation Worries Powell More Than Recession. And he says, I appreciate his honesty, but when the Fed admits it knows little about inflation, how can they expect the market to improve when they're throwing darts? Okay, so the part that's circled here is Mr. Powell responded, we now understand better how little we understand about inflation. I think you're correct. He probably shouldn't. The Fed should always say that we know everything because confidence is part of inflation. And he kind of said, well, we now know how little we know about inflation. And the reality is that is a true statement. I have seen a headline this morning while perusing, I'm trying to remember what it was. Something prices up due to supply chain and inflation. And that's the headline. It's the something, whatever it was. I don't know what it was. The prices up due to supply chain issues and inflation. Okay. Prices up means inflation. Supply chain issue causing prices to go up means inflation. And inflation is inflation. So that's like saying inflation is up because of inflation. That's how we think about inflation. We're going to, anytime prices go up, we call it inflation. Let me explain one time. Inflation is not the cause of a price to go up. If you sell a car, we'll go way back here, that doesn't have power windows for $5,000, and you sell a car with power windows, same car except with power windows, for $5,400, that's not inflation. You added a value that people are willing to pay for. If you're selling the same car later at a higher price, that's inflation. Even if it's a collectible car that suddenly someone discovers was very popular in the 1980s and everybody wants to buy it, that's still inflation. That increase in demand is inflation, but only when it's averaged across everything else at the same time. So if your baseball card goes up in value, that's not inflation. Though it looks like inflation, because inflation is like this average of everything, not baseball cards. You can say baseball cards values went up because of inflation, but really baseball card value going up on average with everything else is inflation, not because it's chicken and egg thing. And you can follow this around. So how well do we understand that? There's a lot of reasons why prices can go up. Lots of reasons. And no one is going to be able to completely catalog all of those reasons. That means that we don't understand all the causes of inflation. Now, the tools that the Fed have to deal with inflation are these massive sledgehammer tools. And we're looking at ants on the ground saying, there's another reason for inflation. There's another. And the sledgehammer hits. It doesn't matter. All the bugs get squished. When they raise interest rates and they stop buying mortgage-backed securities, then they are affecting inflation. It doesn't matter if it comes from the ant or the cockroach. It doesn't matter if it's because the player's card went up or because somebody wants to buy a house. It's all being hit by the same hammer. You have something to add here.
If I could give some perspective on John's question. The fact that the chairman of the Federal Reserve admitted this shows how much we don't know about inflation is not new. He said that on many times and many occasions. It's like the coronavirus pandemic we just had, COVID-19.
I'm glad that you told us specifically which pandemic we're talking about here. It's very important to know.
But,
yes.
But a medical researcher, a virologist, was quoted as saying, it just shows us how much we don't know about infectious disease. And that doesn't mean that we didn't develop a vaccine in record time and that it was far more effective than any vaccine that we've ever come up with before in history, developed much faster in a much more innovative fashion. We have improved tremendously in our knowledge of medicine and in pandemics and viruses, and we're making great strides forward. But any serious researcher or any physician that will be honest with you will tell you the things that we don't know about medical science are enormously greater than what we do know. And every time we find out I do know, we discover probably 10 don't knows. And the same thing is true about economics and specifically about inflation. Milton Friedman pretty well thought he had it all figured out. It's about money. It always is the same thing. It's always, but it's not. He said it always everywhere. It is about money supply. Well, it's not always and everywhere about money supply, because the money supply can remain constant. And if we get a shortage, a sudden shortage of a critical item like oil,
and that affects or gasoline, enough of the economy is affected by that,
then you can get inflation in a big hurry without increasing the money supply. We had a lot of simplistic answers to very complex questions in the past.
Now, and let me throw something else in there that just real quick, we could have just as easily had deflation for the same input.
Yes.
If oil prices go up and it causes everything to get more expensive, so people stop buying because they're not sitting on a lot of money. They just say, oh, I can't buy that. I have to buy something else. That can cause prices to drop very quickly after they rise to way below what they were before, and that causes a deflationary spiral. So having a constant money supply is important during that time period. If you don't have it, you cause deflation. If you do have it, you cause inflation.
Okay, and there's a very important, another, if you will, factor here about inflation. A lot of people who have spoken with me and asked me about it and who I've talked with about inflation are blaming it on the stimulus packages. Now, they always blame it on the third stimulus package if they're a Republican.
And if they're Democrats, they blame it on the first two. And no, I have heard this from Democrats. So don't.
Okay.
There are fiscally conservative Democrats, and they blame Trump.
Yes, yes.
And there are fiscally conservative Republicans, and that's not the majority of the Republicans anymore, by the way. And blame Biden.
And Moody's did a very careful analysis of the various factors that are generating inflation currently. And 0.1% inflation is probably a result of the stimulus. The rest of it is totally different things. It has to do, it's primarily caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the what it did to the price of food, what it did to the price of fuel, what it did to the price of a lot of other oils and things like that that come out of Ukraine that we can't get, and the stuff that's not coming out of Russia that we can't get. So it is the simple answer to this is, we now understand, and certainly Chairman Powell understands, inflation is far more complex and far more difficult to predict than economists thought 50 years ago, or 40 years ago, or 30 years ago. And it's a very complex subject, and simple answers do not give good answers to this subject.
Yeah. The last part of that question was, how can they expect the market to improve when they're throwing darts? And the answer to that is, the estimates on what inflation will be are getting better because we're learning more information, but the information that we're learning is showing that we know a lot less than we thought, or we're learning that we know a lot less than we did. And in that process, we still have this big hammer. So it's not throwing darts. It's more like the collection of data is showing us, hey, there's a lot more that we could gather up here to make better predictions. But the hammer is still what's being used. Raising interest rates at the short-term level and not buying the taper, not buying mortgage-backed securities, and now actively selling their mortgage-backed securities is removing money from the mortgage market as well, which is causing those interest rates to go up. So both ends, on the short term and the long end, you see interest rates going up from the Federal Reserve action. It means that you don't buy the extra playing card that was going up. And you have something here?
In that same interview, and several times in the past, he said the purpose in raising interest rates and in pulling money out of the economy is to reduce consumption pressure until supply can catch up.
Right. And in academia, there is a term for that. It's called demand destruction. And that's what he's doing. If you've been waiting to buy a house, or you're building a house right now and you haven't locked in your interest rate, your demand is falling rather quickly. We can see this in the numbers. The monthly price is causing you to go, whoa, what am I doing here? That's destroying your demand.
Now, what he didn't say, and you have to have been around a long time or else do a lot of research to find out what Paul Volcker was saying at the same time, the last time we had inflation this high. And Paul Volcker was stating at this point that he consciously desired to create a recession, a severe recession. He used that term demand destruction. And I know you said demand destruction. I understand that. What Chairman Powell is trying to say is he just simply wants to tone down demand, not destroy it.
Not all of and it. Right. He's destroying some of it.
We're already headed there. This recent June's inflation reading came in substantially below May's inflation rating. As a matter of fact, if you take the core PCE, which is the one the Fed follows pretty carefully, it's at 4.7%. And the European Union reported its inflation for June as well, 8.6%. Does that sound familiar?
Yep, sounds like us.
They did not have stimulus packages in the European Union, and they have 8.6% inflation. In the United States, we had stimulus packages. We have 8.6% one-year trailing inflation. Great Britain, where they did not have, the United Kingdom, where they did not have stimulus packages, is at 9.1% and expecting to go to 11%, which tells you that the stimulus packages passed by Congress, the three stimulus packages, apparently had no effect on inflation. Now, this is the most interesting point. United Kingdom is teetering on, and the European Union are teetering on the edge of a severe recession. And they acknowledge that, and they're starting to look at lowering interest rates, which will perpetuate inflation, which is going to be really exciting over there. And the euro has fallen close to parity with the dollar, from about $1.40 per euro down to about almost $1 for the euro. The United States currency is rising, which is not indication that we are suffering too badly. As a matter of fact, we're going to come out of this smelling like a rose. Speaking of smelling like a rose, we need to do commercials.
I don't know how that smelling like a rose goes to commercials, but I will take that non sequitur for its face value.
Okay.
If you'd like to join the conversation with us, our email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com, as in the personal wealth coach or Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie. And we will be back on the other side of these vitally important announcements from our sponsors. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We have another question from Inquisitor John here. And this one is much more technical. If inflation wasn't technical enough, his email says in the subject, what was the old gauge that was used? And then there's a circled piece of an article about a new index that's being used by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, called the Corporate Bond Market Distress Index, or CMDI. It's new. It's a new gauge. And what is it? I think your question is, what was the old gauge that was used here? This new index this is real nerd stuff for those of you who aren't in finance. If those of you that like finance, this is like the meat of what we love. A new index measuring something that was not being measured before in one place exists now. What is it? When you're looking at the bond market, just the bond market, there's no place to go to look at it. The stock market I think most people know you can go to Wall Street somewhere and there's exchanges, or in London there's an exchange. The bond market doesn't have a massive centralized exchange. It's much more a banking type market for loans than what we consider like the investment market of the stock market. It's like when a bank is trying to sell a mortgage, they go to their normal people that buy the mortgage from them. And if there's some other people that have come by and made some offers recently, they'll go to them. They don't go to a massive exchange somewhere and say, who's going to offer me the best price for this? Because the bond market, it's too big. And if you and give a really, really simple example, this is not in any way a recommendation about any individual company, by the way. I'm going to use a company that we all know, though, Ford. Ford has a couple of share classes that give different types of voting rights and different concepts on the ownership of Ford. They've got a convertible thing where they've got some bonds that they can convert to stock under certain circumstances. And you might think, well, that's kind of complicated, these different share classes, but there's only a few of them. It's kind of complicated that some bonds can get converted to stocks, but there's just a few of those. Then you have the bond issues. Anytime Ford went to get debt, they get a new loan, and they might have 15 of those in 1 year where they went and got a loan. And each of those loans has a different contract, when it's due, what the interest rate is on it, what's due at the end of it. Are you going to pay it all back, or is it paid interest and principal at the same time? And all of that means that if you go to market and you say, I'm going to buy a Ford stock, it's fairly easy to find a Ford stock to buy. It's fairly easy to say, this is what I'm trying to buy. If you say, I want to buy a Ford bond, well, what maturity date, what interest rate, and is it available? Because some of those bonds aren't available for purchase. Even though they're still out there, the people that own them aren't ready to sell them. So each issue has a smaller group of people that owns it. Ford stock is owned by all of the shareholders. Any individual type of bond is only owned by the people that loaned that initial money or bought it from somebody who did. So the secondary market in bonds is difficult. The primary market of bonds, when they're first getting the loan that is the bond, what was it issued at? Well, this index is coming from the Federal Reserve, it's really the only place that has access to all the data that we're talking about. They're looking at the spread. That's the difference in interest rates between different types of bonds, different types of loans. If you're thinking about your own life, it would be like the difference in interest rate between your mortgage and your credit card. It's probably not the same interest rate. If you have a 4% mortgage, your credit card is probably not a 4% credit card. It might be 0% for a period of time, but then it goes to a much higher number. So what's the difference in the spread between, what is the spread? The spread is the difference between that 4% mortgage and whatever else that is. You could compare that and say, over a long period of time, interest rates and credit cards tend to have this amount of spread or this amount of percentage. And we can look at that, and if you see those getting really out of whack, something's weird in the economy. But the only way to measure that up till now is to go out and get all the individual measurements, get all those spreads, put it all together to look at a lot of the quality differences between one type of bond and another. Anyway, so this new index, they're updating it monthly. This isn't a daily index update. It's a monthly thing because they have a lot of data that they're going. And you have something you want to add. So go ahead.
Well, to answer John's question, it didn't replace anything.
Right. It's new.
There's a lot of different indices that can indicate the distress or distress or stress the bond market is under. There wasn't a single index that would cover it very nicely. And the CMDI has actually been around for probably a decade. It is newly published by the Federal Reserve because it's been around long enough now that people can take a look at it and say, yes, it did accurately reflect the stress in the bond market. For instance, during the 2007 through 2009 extreme bond market stress scenario we went through, we literally did not have any single indicator. We've got an indicator for stocks, got a volatility indicator for stocks, the VIX. We've got a lot of things that we can measure stock stress with, but we don't have anything that we can use to measure bond stress. We just have to, previously the Federal Reserve and other people had to look at lots of different indices and make a guesstimate as to what that all meant. Now they've got one that seems to be fairly accurate in predicting stress in the bond market, or reporting stress in the bond market. And so that's what the CMDI is.
And it's kind of telling us something interesting right now. It's saying that the investment grade, not junk, not icky stuff bonds, are under distress right now. And they're under the same distress. If you were to overlay that with the VIX for the stock market, people are selling bonds for corporate America at about the same rate that they're selling stocks for corporate America. The unusual part of this is that the high yield market is not being affected as much right now, which is reverse. It's reverse because people are jumping into the high yield market saying, hey, the interest rates are already high there. That's scary. It's really, really scary.
Yeah. It's particularly interesting in the fact that, as you mentioned, the investment grade bond market is under far more stress than the high yield bond market, which is just reversed from what's normal. And I think I can understand the reason for that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The investment grade bond market has been issuing a lot of debt at extremely low interest rates over the last several years. And with interest rates going up, the value of that, the long-term debt, the 30-year bonds that were issued by Apple, for example, nobody thinks Apple's going under, but all of a sudden the 2%, 1-point-something percent and 2% bonds issued by Apple, if you held them, all of a sudden they're not worth very much because people can get AAA-rated 4% today. And that, if you have a really long-term bond, that conceivably cuts the value of your bond in half. If you try to sell it on the open market, which is a high stress situation. So it's sort of an interesting scenario. We saw this happen, by the way, according to the CMDI, back in 2018 as well. And nothing too terribly bad came of it. It happened in 2018. It happened in 2019. I'm not too concerned about
it. Yeah, it tends to happen when there's a big shift in demand or interest rates. And if you look back there at those time periods, the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates. When interest rates get raised, they have a bigger impact on things with the lowest interest rate, which is the highest quality debt. But it means that the principal is affected more and people go, oh, I need to get out of this. High yield is going to have a comeuppance on interest rates like this. One of the factors here is, in order to really understand this new index, we don't have 50 years of data. We have 10 years of data. And we would have to look back 50 years to see the last time we were at this point in the interest rate cycle.
The Fed, the New York Fed, is publishing data on the CMDI back to 2005 now. Because it was actually been run that long. It just wasn't published at that point.
Yeah.
And it's really, if you go to the newyorkfed.org research policy, you look for corporate bond market distress index, it's pretty cool. It's a pretty cool graph.
And it's fun to look at if you're a nerd
like us. Geeks like us just sit around and stare at graphs like this and go, wow, did you see that? Look at that peak.
Look at the relationship between that peak and this peak over here.
Look at the correlation between this and the anti-correlation over here and the negative correlation up there.
But that doesn't mean it's causation. Maybe this has a different cause. This is our conversation on a day-to-day basis. So if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we got another hour coming up. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have a voicemail rating locally at
254-947-1111.
Or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. The contact us form is there. You can email us directly at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. On our webpage, you've got radio programs going back lots of years, newsletters going back lots of years. You can sign up for our newsletter there as well. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back next hour.